From the seventh chapter of Judges. And I think we won't read it in advance, but just read the verses as we need to look at them. By way of introduction to this passage in Judges, I want to read a paragraph from an article which appeared in the French communist newspaper Peace and Liberty back in 1954. And in this editorial, which appeared in this communist newspaper, the first few sentences read, "The gospel of Jesus Christ is a much more powerful weapon for the renewal of society than is our Marxist doctrine." And we can certainly agree with him on that first sentence. But he goes on to say, "All the same, it is we who will finally beat you. We are only a handful, and you Christians are numbered by the millions. But if you remember the story of Gideon and his 300 companions, you will understand why I am right." And so the communist editor found something in the story of Gideon and his 300 companions, which made them believe they had something there to imitate in the spread of what they believed. So this morning we're going to consider Gideon and his 300 companions. And in order that we might have a subject for this passage of Scripture, we'd like to place it in the form of a question. And this question is, three kinds of men, which kind are you? And when I say which kind are you, I'm thinking which kind am I? A pastor friend of mine was going to preach on the publican and the sinner that we read about over in Luke one Sunday. And he asked his associate what he thought would be a good title for this passage. And so his associate said, "Well, how about this one? Two men in a pew. Which one are you?" So we're considering here three kinds of men. Which kind are you? And, of course, we use this term men very broadly. I heard Mr. Tom Olson say once that it is a well-known fact that in our culture, man embraces woman. And so this is theological as well as otherwise. Now as a little background to the seventh chapter of Judges, you remember that the nation of Israel had been conquered by their neighbors, the Midianites. And one of the worst features of this was that just when the harvest of their grain was ready, that the Midianites would cross the border. Very much as we have a situation down in, or have had down in Vietnam, where that the Viet Cong would come in and take a large share of the rice harvest. But in this case, they took it all. And so the situation was getting worse and worse. And so, as they did so many times in this book of Judges, the children of Israel cried out for deliverance. And God heard them. And he said, "All right, I've heard your prayer, and I'm going to deliver you." And so he sent a messenger to a man by the name of Gideon, who apparently had had little or no military experience. And he said, "By your hand, I'm going to deliver the nation of Israel out of the hand of the Midianites." Gideon was very much surprised. And you remember that he, although he had had some miraculous evidence that the messenger of God was authentic, he told the Lord that he wanted to be real sure that he got this communication straight. So you remember he said that he had an old sheepskin out in the shed there behind the house, and he threw it out on the ground, and he told the Lord, "Now, in the morning, I'm going out and check on this sheepskin. And if there's dew on the sheepskin, but all the ground is dry, then I'll know that I got the message straight. So he went out the next morning, looked all around, and he couldn't find any trace of dampness, any place on the ground. But he picked up a sheepskin and wrung it out, and he got a bowl full of water. So Gideon asked the Lord not to be impatient. He said, now, I just want to be sure about this. I'm going to throw that thing out there again tonight. And if there's dew all over the ground, but this wool is completely dry, then I'll know that I have the message. So you know what happened? He put it out, and it happened just exactly that way. And the skin was dry, but there was moisture every place else. So Gideon did whatever was necessary to do and got the army mobilized, called up all the reserves, and they met in a little area not too far north of Jerusalem. Now, one of the things that makes me think that Gideon probably didn't have any military experience, that he didn't know what to do. I think he had seen a few military formations. So he probably said to himself at least, I've noticed whenever military people get together that they line up in rows and the senior officers sort of march up and down in front. So he got them in some kind of formation and then began to walk up down in front of them, but he didn't know what to do next. While this was going on, the Lord communicated with him, I don't know just how, and he said, if you will review a little bit your knowledge of the 20th chapter of Deuteronomy, you will know what a military commander is supposed to do after the army has been mobilized. And so we have it over in Deuteronomy chapter 20 and verse 8. And I'll read part of this here. The command for officers in the Israelite army. And the officers shall speak further unto the people, and they shall say, what man is there that is fearful and faint-hearted? Let him go and return unto his own house, lest his brethren's heart faint, as well as his heart. Now, I don't know how practical it would be to have a law of war like this today. I don't know just what would happen, but we do know what happened. After that, Gideon got up in front of this recently mobilized army, and he said, now, if there's anybody that's reported here for duty who is afraid, who's fearful, or faint-hearted, you can return to your own home. Because according to what we have over there in the law, not only will you be useless in battle, but you will dishearten the man next to you by your cowardice. So go home. And I think that Gideon was probably surprised to see 22,000 out of his 32,000 man army take off for home. So we have the first group we're going to speak about. Numerically, they are 22,000. But we want to characterize them a little bit different from numerically. And so we'd like to describe them this morning as saying this 22,000 were those who had no heart for the battle. No heart for the battle. If there's any fighting going on, count me out. Now, I think there's mighty good reason to have an attitude of that sort. This morning I received a letter from one of our representatives out in the Orient working from the military, reporting on a trip he had made to visit our representative down in Vietnam. And I want to read some of the things that he wrote. He said at Ben Hue, through the influence of a Christian doctor friend of ours, we were able to visit the men in the hospital that had recently been wounded. We saw them unload the wounded from helicopters and race them into emergency, and watched some of the operations, some with limbs missing, others full of bullets and shrapnel, and yet others not so fortunate. We were able to mill around and talk to these men about Christ. I believe one lieutenant I talked with accepted Christ. Another, a young Christian, was so hungry to talk about Christ that he forgot all about his pains. One arm paralyzed, one leg full of shrapnel, and the doctors hadn't even started to operate. And his stomach full of bullets. He is about 19 years old. As I showed him the Bible study, he just lit up and said, "I've been wanting someone to help me like this since I became a Christian 1.5 years ago." When I suggested it might be a while before he could use his right arm and fill in the blanks, and what Harv had given him was book one up here on the, it's up here on the board. He said it might be some while before he'd be able to write. He said, "While I was in high school, it occurred to me that someday I may not be able to use my right arm, and I learned to write left-handed, so I shouldn't have any trouble," and so forth. This is just one of the situations that we receive descriptions about, and we can see that there's plenty of reason, humanly speaking, that a man will be faint-hearted when it comes to the battle where that this can likely be the result. And so these 22,000, I think, had seen more, and they knew what they were up against, and they made their decision. There was a chance to leave, and so off they went. Now, I know from experience, as some of you do, that it's very difficult to be motivated to fight in the war, that you're not just sure to the extent that God is in it and that you're working for Him. But I feel that it should be an easy thing, and it is an easy thing, to join in a battle where that it's a battle that God has commanded that we join in. Some of us were talking the other day about the Vietnam War, which seems so difficult to explain. We had been visiting with one of our Chinese Christian friends who told us that he knew that because of the thousands of Chinese who had been praying that Red China would be delivered so that the gospel could go freely in that great country, he said, God's going to do it just as surely as He delivered His people Israel because others prayed. And he said, perhaps the reason that this war is going on, that's so hard to explain, it's going to result in this prayer being answered and Red China open to the gospel. And as we reflected on that, I thought, what better way could there be? And I think I could actually become interested in laying down my life, if necessary, to open up that country for the gospel of Jesus Christ. But what we're talking about here is not physical warfare, but the spiritual warfare. Those who had no heart for the battle. I believe that it's probably easier to lay down our lives for Christ than it is to live for Him in the battle. That's the easy way out. So the kind of men that Gideon had, as we're making this spiritual application, is those who have a heart for Jesus Christ, just as willing to live for Him as they are to lay down their lives. Now there's more we could say about this group, but I think we'd better get on to the next group. 22,000. How do we characterize them? Those who had no heart for the battle, which I think spiritually is to say that they have no heart for Jesus Christ. You've perhaps heard about Napoleon's soldier had a piece of a spear or steel of some kind lodged right over his heart. And as a surgeon performed emergency surgery out on the battlefield without any anesthetic, the deeper he probed, the more that it hurt. And so he apologized to the soldier, and he said, "I'm sorry to be hurting you, but we've got to get that piece of steel out." And the soldier said, "Doctor, if you go any deeper, you're going to cut right into my heart." And he said, "If you open it up, you'll find Napoleon." We need men who have a heart for Christ in the way that this soldier had a heart for Napoleon. Well, let's see what happened next with Gideon. Here, from an original army of 32,000, he's now reduced to 10,000. And as the Lord looked over the situation with him, he said, "You still have too many. When you win with this group, you're not going to give the credit where it belongs, so I want to test these fellows a bit further." So he indicated to Gideon that they were to have a little march of some kind. If you're familiar with these hills over there in that region north of Jerusalem, you know that it's up and down. And having visited that country, you can see why some of the Bible writers used the terminology they did when they said in the day of the Lord that every valley is going to be filled and every hill made low. I think as they advanced in age, just the thought of taking a little journey up and down those steep hills made them tired. So Gideon got his remaining 10,000 out, and they had a little marching practice up and down the hills. And the more they marched, the tireder they got. And not being prepared for a long campaign, I think they were short of water and got thirsty. So pretty soon they came to a little stream, a tributary, into the Jordan. I think perhaps it wasn't over a few feet wide. And no sooner had they caught sight of this than all semblance of order and discipline vanished, and they rushed right down. And where it was narrow enough, some of them put one hand across and one on the near side and put their faces down in just like a horse or a dog drinking water. My, how refreshing that was. But they were in Midianite territory, and Midianite reconnaissance patrols were keeping an eye on everything that they did. Among that 10,000, however, there were 300 who realized what the real issues were. And so they were thirsty, and they wanted a drink, and they wanted to cool off their face and their necks from that dust. But as they went down to the water, they made a cup with their hand, brought it up, and while they were drinking, they never ceased to scan that horizon to look for a movement that would indicate that there was a Midianite with an arrow or with a spear or some other weapon. And so after having had this test, God spoke to Gideon again, and he said, "Now you've got 9,700 more that can join the 22,000 that have gone home. Dismiss them also." So we have our second group. How shall we describe them? I think we can describe them as saying that they were those who had the heart but not the skill for the battle. Now, these men were not cowards. Some Bible students have figured out that the army of the Midianites and their allies numbered a little more than 130,000. And so the men in these 10,000 knew what the issues were, and they were not afraid. They were not afraid to lay down their lives if necessary. But when it came to the stability and the skill that they needed to be on the job and on the alert, they just didn't have it. Whenever I read this, it reminds me of Job 15:16. In this passage, you remember that God asks a question, and he says, "How much more abominable and filthy is man that drinketh iniquity like water?" man is attracted to and will take a drink of cold water without much forethought or preparation. So God says that he drinks iniquity the same way. Several years ago, I was in the crew of a ship which was sailing down the South Pacific, right near the equator, and it was a hot day. And our cold water, chilled water facilities were taxed to the limit. I remember standing one afternoon next to this big chilled water fountain. I watched fellows come down the passageway, no thought of being thirsty, but when they would see that cool dew standing out all over that thing, they would stop so quick they'd nearly lose their footing to go over there and take a drink. I asked one of the fellows who went up and down that passageway quite a bit one day, I said, "How many times have you stopped and gotten a drink there today?" And he thought for a minute and he said, "I don't recall having stopped at all." Well, I thanked him because that proved the point. How much more abominable and filthy is man that drinketh iniquity like water? We see sin outwardly, we respond to it, partake, and go on our way often hardly conscious of what we've done. I think that the water is typical of all of our physical appetites and infirmities. The ancient theologians have done a good job in cataloging sin. And they believed that there wasn't any sin that couldn't be cataloged under the headings. You remember there's seven capital sins of pride, anger, envy, covetousness, lust, sloth, and gluttony. I wonder in your life and my life, does the devil know our weakness? Does he know what he can hold out in front of us to trip us up and keep us out of the battle? I think that he does. Over in 2 Timothy 2:24 through 26, you remember, there's some instruction given. And then Paul says, "And that they may recover themselves out of the snare of the devil, who are taken captive by him at his will." Yes, the devil knows how to take men and women who have a heart for Jesus Christ and a heart for battle right out of the battle as he holds out temptation and sees them respond. So we have the second group here of 9,700 which had the heart but not the skill to engage in battle. Well, don't you think that Gideon was mighty glad that he'd put that fleece out about this time? I used to think that this demonstrated a lack of faith. But I think God permitted this because he only knew what Gideon was going to be confronted with. Now, by this time, most of the day had worn on. It was getting toward dark. And Gideon knew that he had to attack the Midianites, and he only had 300. The Lord saw his apprehension, and I think he said to him, "Now, Gideon, you're still not sure, are you?" And Gideon said, "No, you certainly read my heart and mind right." So the Lord said, "Why don't you and your chief of staff make a little reconnaissance tour down to the Midianite camp?" So I don't know whether they blacked their faces or what they did, but here they took a tour. And they were trying to pick up some kind of pertinent information. So pretty soon they heard a couple of Midianites engaged in a conversation. So they went up to listen. And one of these Midianites said to the other, he said, "You know, I had the strangest dream last night." And the other Midianite said, "You did? What was it?" And he said, "Well, we were camped here." Let me read it from verse 13 of chapter 7. "Behold, I dreamed a dream, And lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled in the host of Midian, and came into a tent, and smote it as it fell, and overturned it, that the tent lay along. He said, we were in my dream. I looked up the hill, and the Israelites up there were having lunch, and one of them dropped a biscuit. And that biscuit come rolling down the hill. It rolled right into the camp, and the first thing that got in its way was one of our big barracks tents, and it knocked it flat, and then went right on through the camp. So the other soldier said, I knew it. I knew it. His fellow answered and said, this is nothing else save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. For into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host. Well, as soon as Gideon and his chief of staff heard this, they said, that settles it. We're all ready to go. So he went up and he rounded up his 300. And he said, fellows, let's get ready to attack, because God has delivered these people into our hands. So it's time to get organized and come up with a plan B, since I think anything that Gideon had been thinking about involved a few more than 300. So we read in verse 16 that he divided the 300 men into the three companies. And he appointed a company commander to take charge of 100, another to take charge of another 100, and he took the other 100. And so they kind of pestered him a little bit and says, what's the plan of attack? And he said, well, I don't know. I know we're going to surround them. That's the first thing we're going to do. And then you just watch me. I'll have one company on one side and one the other, and I'll tell you what to do when the time comes. But he said, I guess we don't want to go into this thing with our bare hands. So he looked over here, and here was a pile of bugles that this 31,700 had left. And he said, everybody grab a bugle. Now he said, since we're going to attack after night, we need a light, so everybody get a torch, get it lighted. And then he thought, now that's kind of foolish to march down there with this torch. So he looked over where the commissary department had so recently evacuated and saw a lot of these big clay pitchers. And he said, now everybody grab a pitcher. And you put that over your left hand and hold it just right so that it can get enough oxygen that it'll keep burning, and it'll put a little light down to your feet, but it won't be visible at the distance. So here you are, you've got this hot burning torch in one hand with this clay pitcher over it, and the bugle in the other. He says, now we're ready to go. And then Gideon showed the first great flash of genius, I think, at this point, as he said, now wait a minute. It's, I don't know, maybe 10 or 10:30 at night. We've had a hard day. Let's rest a little bit, and we won't attack till after midnight. I don't know whether he reasoned this out or whether God just gave him the wisdom in it. But he didn't attack. Verse 19 says, so Gideon and the 100 that were with him came into the outside of the camp in the beginning of the middle watch, and they had but newly set the watch. Now, many of you fellows particularly have had military experience, and you know that the one of the things that we never get used to in the military is standing a mid-watch at 12 to 4. Nobody ever looks forward to it at all. In fact, generally, what we do is go to bed early and try to get rested up for it, and then our mind is so much on it that we don't go to sleep, just toss and turn, get up and stand the thing. It's more like 12 hours than 4, and when you go back to bed, you dream that you're still on watch. So it really wrecks the night. But Gideon knew that the fellows, the sentries who had just gone off watch, would be dead to the world, and you couldn't rouse them with anything. And the people who had just come on watch would be so dopey and sleepy that they wouldn't know what was going on as they were wandering around in the dark with their eyes half closed. So he said, this is when we're going to attack. Just after the mid-watch has been set. So they came to the edge of the camp. And we don't know just what the battle plan was, but I think they were probably spread out in a long line. And since the Midianite camp was pretty large, that they were pretty far apart. Now, Gideon gave the instruction. And he said, the first thing I'm going to do is blow my bugle. And when I blow the bugle, you all blow your bugle. Now, I don't know how you feel about it, but it seems to me that it would be very unusual if you could dismiss 31,700 and end up with 300 expert buglers in that army. I kind of have the feeling that there were quite a few of those 300 that had never had a bugle to their lips in their life. But they all had a bugle, and they had to blow it. And Gideon said, when I blow mine, you blow yours. So this was the first indication that the Midianites had that something was coming off. When they heard all along this edge of the camp these strange sounds coming out of these 300 bugles. Now, if you would place yourself in the Midianite camp, I think that you can pretty well figure out just what happened. Here were the Midianites, most of them asleep. They all knew how the Israelite army was to be organized, about 100 to a company. And in each company, they knew there was a company commander, and as a part of his staff, he had a bugler, and he had a signalman, and probably had his heaviest bodyguard right around him. So they heard the bugle, they looked up, and then Gideon had given the next command to break the pitcher, hold up the torch. So all along the edge of the camp here, the Midianites woke out of their sleep, they heard the bugle, and saw the torch, and then a shout. And it never dawned on one of them, I don't think, that there weren't 99 men ahead of every one of those buglers and ahead of every one of those torches. So they felt people moving next to them there in the camp, and they wondered how those Israelites had penetrated so deep so quick. But the first thought was to fight it out, so they grabbed a sword. And over here in verse 22, and the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host. So throughout the camp, anybody that moved was thought by the Midianite to be an enemy. So they fought it out, and they hacked each other to pieces. And as soon as they got running room, they retreated. So this is, in brief, the story of the battle. Now, how should we characterize these 300? I think that we characterize them by saying these 300 had both the heart and the skill for the battle. And this is the kind of people that Christ is looking for today. Those who have both the heart and the skill. I think we might comment briefly on the order of battle. And Gideon had it just right. The first thing they were to do was to blow the trumpet. Many Bible scholars believe that throughout Scripture, the trumpet is symbolic of the Christian's joy. Many things in Scripture that indicate that. And so the first quality for being like the 300 is to have the joy that Christ intended that we should have. Now, the next thing he told them to do was to break the pitcher so that the light could be seen and used. And this reminds me of 2 Corinthians 4, 7, speaking of the excellency of the glory of Christ. The verse says, "But we have this treasure in earthen vessels." We have this treasure in earthen vessels. So even though we have the Christian's joy, too many of us still have the excellency of the glory of God locked up inside of us. And it can never get out until the clay vessel is broken. Some of you have perhaps taken or heard about the Dale Carnegie Leadership Training Course, session number 5. This is quite a session. And the week before, as assignments are given to the students, in these classes, everyone has to deliver two-minute speeches. So the assignment to the instructor is next week, come prepared to give two-minute speeches. One of them is on the incident in your life that has made you the angriest of anything you can remember. You tell us about it next week. But in the first session, you pick the next to the most angering incident you've ever heard. So you've got all week to really get wrought up about this. Now, in addition to this, as you come in next Sunday, next meeting time, every one of you bring an armload of newspapers that are rolled up with rubber bands around them, all you can carry. So as we come into class for this fifth session, every student unloads his car and carries this big roll of newspapers in. The instructor's behind the table, and he piles them up on the table, and they nearly come to the ceiling. So we wonder what's going to happen. Well, everyone gives their first speech on the incident which has angered them next to the most. The instructor appoints three hecklers back in the audience. And all time the speaker's speaking, these three are trying to drown him out. Now, it doesn't do any good not to enter into this wholeheartedly, because after each speaker has given his speech, the instructor takes a vote. Everybody that thinks he did his best, thumbs up. Everybody that thinks that he didn't do his best, thumbs down. And if the majority votes this way, he's got to do it again. So finally, we labor through the first half. Then comes the second. This time, the instructor appoints everybody in the class to heckle. And he takes these newspapers, about three rolls in each hand, and while the speaker is speaking, he gets on the opposite side of the table from him and beats the table with one hand and beats the speaker on the head and shoulders with the other. All the class is heckling. So he has to deliver this speech about the thing that made him the most angry of anything he can remember. I remember one of the men in my class was the contractor who built the Air Force Academy Stadium. And he had a tax problem. And he was getting warmed up during the recesses around there. And I'm sure glad he wasn't angry at me. Well, might as well get into it, because after the speech is over, the instructor said, "How many think he did his best?" And there are ladies in this too. Half a person hadn't. Do it again. Well, finally, the last speaker had given his message. The instructor was walking around up there nearly knee-deep in shredded paper. And then came the very dramatic moment. He said, "Look at all of that torn paper up there in front. Looks like broken shells, doesn't it? Eggshells. And you could see the resemblance, all this torn paper." He said, "This is the coming out of the shell session." He said, "For the first time in your lives tonight, most of you have been released from your inhibitions that you've been building up all your life. But tonight, some of you really let go. And for every one of you that did, he said you'll never have trouble again standing up in front of people. You will never have any difficulty expressing yourself. And it was amazing as the class went on to see his prediction fulfilled, as people who had started out the class, afraid to look up, who wanted to hide behind their coat or something, get up, and my, you would think that they were the most experienced orators that you could ever expect to hear. Now my point in telling this, there's a lot of Christians who have the heart for Christ, I think have the joy that he intends that they should have, but the earthen vessel has never been broken. And so this is what happened that night. As Gideon said, you blow the trumpet and then smash that pitcher against the tree. You're not going to need that anymore. And wave the torch. And then he said, speak up. You bugle, you wave the torch, and then you speak out and say, the sword of the Lord and of Gideon. And then verse 21 climaxes it, where that he says, and they stood, every man in his place. The 300 never moved. They just stood there. And the Midianites were defeated by the men that weren't there. The 99 that only existed in their imagination. We don't think that this is the way to evangelize the world, is to stand still, do we? But we're reminded that these were standing in the midst of an enemy. I feel that today the challenge is unconventional evangelism. It is very, very difficult to get people to come in and to sit under the influence of the gospel of their own accord. In fact, I don't know any command in Scripture which says that we are to get together in a meeting and sit down and wait for them to come in. Several years ago, when we changed our method of working with servicemen from a service center to what we're doing now, one of the things which persuaded us was, we didn't know any place in Scripture where it says, set up a service center, and then you sit there and wait for the unsaved to come in and hear the gospel. The command is to get out in the middle of them, where that they are. So the order of the day is unconventional evangelism. Getting out where the people are. And giving this threefold testimony. The Christian's joy. The flesh is shattered. They can see the light. And then they can hear our voice. And when opposition comes, we stand as a target. I'm very interested in what I think are the signs of the times today. I believe as Christ has given us information concerning his return, he indicates that certain things are going to happen among the Gentile rulers of the world, that the Jews have to be in a certain place, and there's certainly great activity in that realm. But also that there has to be an ecclesiastical organization which is the most powerful force on earth. And I've been accumulating clippings, and I'm amazed that hardly a week goes by that something isn't added to show that this ecclesiastical force is being formed. Here in the United States, you know, we have a movement of 8 of our largest denominations to become one by 1970. And I understand, although I cannot back this up, that there's lobbying going on by a council in the United States that would forbid the government to allow the airwaves, radio and television, to be used by anyone who isn't a member of this council. And furthermore, that there's a lobbying move that the tax exemption, which the government allows to contributions, will not be allowed to religious groups who are not a member of the giant organization, a part of the world organization. So things are shaping up. And unconventional evangelism is going to be more and more the order of the day. I'm sure you read in the papers a while back, about a month ago, one of the most popular seniors up at the University of Colorado, who was brutally slain. Her testimony was given in the paper the Sunday before in her church in Boulder. She had sung a solo, and it was moment by moment. She was one of the leaders on campus of Campus Crusades for Christ, which you know is a militant organization which has stirred up much opposition. Her murder has not been located. We do not know whether or not there is any connection. But we believe that the time is coming that opposition to the gospel in any form is going to become more and more pronounced. And the only way that God is going to get through is through men and women like Gideon's 300 that have both the heart and the skill to shine and to shout and to stand. I wish this morning that I were able to tell you how you could get the heart and the skill to stand for Jesus Christ in any circumstance. But I don't know the answer to that. But if I understand the parable of the sower in Mark 4, Luke 8, and Matthew 13, that which Jesus Christ is teaching is this: you are responsible, and I am responsible for the condition of my heart. Proverbs 4:13, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. So this one thing I know: the condition of my heart is not due to environment. It isn't due to heredity. It isn't the fault of those around me. I and I alone am finally and ultimately responsible for the condition of my heart as it relates to Jesus Christ. As for the skills that go in the warfare for Christ, John Crawford and I were talking about this the other night, and he said, I feel that what the navigators have to offer that is of more value than anything else are tools. And so most of this week is oriented in the direction of trying to give you skills to be acquired and to pass on so that you will be fully equipped, fully outfitted, as the verse you studied talked about this morning. Let me relate one final incident. Several years ago, after the conclusion of World War II, you remember that many football players gravitated to our military academies. And the military academy at West Point built up quite a team. In fact, they had the longest winning streak in the history of collegiate football up to this point. But this particular year, the boys down at the Naval Academy decided it was time to do something about this. And so intent were they on getting ready for this big postseason game that they only won two games in their regular season. But the big day arrived. They came together on Soldiers Field the Saturday after Thanksgiving, And the spectators saw something that was completely unanticipated. As the Navy not only won a victory, but it was a one-sided victory. And the Army didn't look like the team that had just accumulated the longest winning streak of Indian history. On Monday morning after the game, the Admiral in command down at the Naval Academy found on his desk a letter from the general who was superintendent of the Military Academy at West Point. And in the letter, the general rehearsed some of the times that he had been engaged in amphibious operations during World War II. He said, we had some tough ones. And he said, in every case, at the critical moment, it looked like that the Navy wasn't going to be able to get us ashore. But he said, just when things looked the darkest, it seemed to me as though there was an extra man standing alongside every Navy man helping him. And then they went ahead and got the job done. And we got the landing made. He said, I hadn't thought about that for a few years. But out there on the football field Saturday, he said, I saw a 12th man. And he said, that's what made the difference. He said, I know that with that 12th man that the Navy has, if we ever have to work together again in an amphibious operation with the help of the 12th man, we're going to succeed. And he said, I want you to know that I was mighty happy to see him out there at work on Saturday. Now, I don't think the general was talking about God. I don't know what he was talking about, whether it was spirit or morale or whatever it was. But this I know, that God is looking for men and women who will be targets, who will stand. And if he can just get somebody up there for props, why, he'll bring in all the reserve and resources that are needed to ensure victory in battle. Three kinds of men. Which kind are we? No heart for the battle, heart but no skill, or like Gideon's 300 that the communist editor commended, who had both the heart and the skill for the battle.